Information is free.
The law?
There is hope.
When ignorance is converted into knowledge,
we care.
And
it shows.
The law?
The country.
You will remember nothing you have seen or heard here.
Whether he went on with the diary, or whether he did not cooperate, it made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same.
Oh my God, it's Bad Friday, my friends, and welcome to episode 68 of Media Monarchy. It's March 21st, 2008, coming to you from the Portland Radio Authority and the Revere Radio Network. Tons of horrible news to go over this week, like no other. We got war games, drills, exercises, simulations, and desensitization. CCTV complete control takeover video, bloody terrible anniversaries like the Iraq War, the My Lai massacre, and the murder of Rachel Corrie. We got the latest on 9/11 books, bombs, and beliefs, weather wars, Arthur C. Clarke, Charles Manson, manna from Emmanuel Goldstein, and our savior has come to town. It's episode 68, March 21st, 2008, MediaMonarchy.com.
When the Führer says, "We is the master race, we heil, heil!" Right in the Führer's face, not to love the Führer is a great disgrace, so we heil, heil! Right in the Führer's face. When Herr Goebbels says, "We own the world in space, we heil, heil!" Right in Herr Goebbels' face, when Herr Göring says, "He'll never bomb this place, we heil, heil!" Right in Herr Göring's face. Are we not the Superman? Aryan pure Superman.
Yeah, we are the Superman.
Super duper Superman.
Is this Nazi land so good? Would you leave it if you could?
Yeah, this Nazi land is good. We would leave it if we could.
We bring the world new order. I'll hit this world new order.
Everyone of foreign race will love the Führer's face when we bring to the world disorder.
When the Führer says, "He is the master race, we heil, heil!" Right in the Führer's face, not to love the Führer is a great disgrace, so we heil, heil! Right in the Führer's face. The Führer says, "We is the master race, we heil, heil!" Right in the Führer's face, not to love the Führer is a great disgrace, so we heil, heil!
Right in the Führer's face!
Going back many, many, many decades for that one, that's Spike Jonze and the Führer's face. I think last spring I played Springtime for Hitler, so maybe it was time for another satirical Hitler piece. Welcome, once again, my friends, to Media Monarchy. My name's James. I'm your host and webmaster of MediaMonarchy.com since 2005. And since 2006, I've been doing the radio version of Media Monarchy, and this is episode 68, coming to you March 21st, 2008, from the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.org, every Friday morning at 10 Pacific Time, and on the Revere Radio Network, revereradionetwork.com or revereradio.info, Sunday nights at 7 Eastern Time, and you can, of course, hit me up, MySpace, Dig, YouTube, Yahoo, with Media Monarchy as your keyword, and the podcasts radioforall.net and archive.org had about 80 downloads last week, so that is fucking great, and I thank you guys very much. And hopefully you keep spreading the word. So it's the first of spring. It's Bad Friday today. And as I mentioned, all saints be praised, our Savior has come to town. Barack Obama is here. He's so close to me right now, you wouldn't believe it. So, not up on MediaMonarchy.com, but I just grabbed it from local K2. Tickets all gone for Obama's Portland rally. A friend told me at work last night that he saw, maybe it was Craigslist or something or other, people were trying to give away Dave Matthews tickets for the Obama event, which were free, but you have to have a ticket. And I believe people were lining up quite early. Doors opened at 7:30, and there are lots of cops and lots of choppers flying around. I know he seems appealing, because, of course, next to Hillary, he's absolutely appealing. I'll admit that. But he's the same old globalist wrapped up in a nice new package. I know he gives some rhetoric about ending the war and bringing troops back. Although, he may have something there with bringing some troops out of Iraq because, you know, he and his foreign policy advisors, Zbigniew Brzezinski, they're going to need some extra troops when they go into Pakistan. So that's all I'm going to say. Don't believe the hype. And I got so much news for you up on MediaMonarchy.com. I got hundreds of pages. So, kicking off, we're going to hit a bunch of war games and drills and exercises and simulations. Desensitization. So first, Jerusalem Post, Israel to hold massive emergency drill in the face of a possible escalation with Syria and Iran's efforts to obtain a nuclear weapon. Parts of Israel will shut down next month in what security officials say will be the largest emergency exercise in Israel's history. The drill, which is being organized by the newly established National Emergency Authority, will take place over 5 days starting Sunday, April 6th. And even leading up to that, they have other hospital emergency exercises. Because the terror is real. So, Jerusalem Newswire also has it, Israel to hold massive drill. Syria war is possible. Largest ever emergency exercise. So that's coming up in April, like I said, so we're going to keep eyes peeled for that. UPI is also covering it. Israel plans drills in face of nuke threat. But if we head on over to Russia and the Russian News and Information Agency, RIA Novosti, Russian bear bombers to hold exercises in Far East. This is Dateline Moscow. Russian bear strategic bombers will conduct exercises in Russia's Far East on March 20th through the 22nd. That's this weekend. Crews of an air regiment equipped with Tu-95MS bombers will participate in planned flight drills and long-range patrols over the Pacific. If you'll recall, last week we covered some of the recent flybys that Russian bombers have given U.S. aircraft carriers. Just a little, you know, flyby. A little wave. It's also up on ITAR-TASS. Military exercises begin in Russian region. So that's the war games and exercises abroad. But we have lots of simulations and bioterror drills and pandemic exercises and faux anthrax attacks, all designed to make you think the terror threat is real, even though you have a better chance of probably having a car wreck. So if we hit up studlife.com, which is the school newspaper for University of St. Louis, Washington University in St. Louis. University test disaster readiness with faux anthrax attack. University administrators, St. Louis Department of Health officials, and more than 200 campus volunteers collaborated in a public health drill that simulated the distribution of medication at one of the campus buildings in the event of a terrorist anthrax attack, which I'm sure an anthrax attack on a St. Louis university is a really, really high, high profile target. They set up their own little emergency page. It's emergency.wustl.edu, and it says emergency status, and it has a big exclamation point. Currently, there is no emergency at Washington University. But of course, in the event, they'll, I'm sure, post it up after the fact. Let's get a little influenza. Health and Human Services. This is coming from CIDRAP, C-I-D-R-A-P, and that stands for Center for Infectious Diseases in Research and Policy. So Health and Human Services include online services in their pandemic communication drill. Health and Human Services recently held a tabletop exercise to assess how it could best work with the news media, including blogs and other online-only information sources to get status updates and vital health information to the blah-blah-blah-blah. The important part, checking this out, the session was held March 17th at the Health and Human Services headquarters in D.C. Representatives from online avian flu information services such as Avian Flu Diary, Flu Trackers, Flu Wiki, WebMD, and SIDRAP News participated in the exercise along with those from ABC News, NPR, and Reuters. So getting in bed with the terror drills. There's another one from CIDRAP. CDC pandemic exercises highlights drug mitigation and travel issues. This was in Michigan. And of course, talking about migrant workers and a possible pandemic. You can hit up links and read more about Health and Human Services. Jimmy Carter set it up. But if we jump to north of the border, you know, the border that's there for the time being until it all gets rolled into the North American Union. But up in Canada, eco-terror scenario plays out at the Vancouver port. A radiation signature was detected in a shipping container at the port of Vancouver. An improvised bomb containing radioactive material exploded, leaving a dozen people injured and contaminated. This fictional scenario was cooked up by the Federal Center of Security Science to let federal and local emergency personnel practice for a real-life bioterror attack. And so again, like I've said, all these things, federalizing your local police and civil servants. If we jump to Contra Costa Times, Livermore Laboratories' Sandia will take central role in bioterrorism response. Like a bioterror crisis hotline, a new center in the Lawrence Livermore Laboratory has become the nerve center for responding to the intentional or accidental release of a dangerous biological agent, most of which, of course, end up coming from government facilities. As we've gone over here many times, Lawrence Livermore isn't exactly the safest place. But you can hit up the Sandia National Laboratory and their press releases and their, oh, what do they call it? BioWatch Indoor Reachback Center. That sounds kind of fun. But moving on to dailypress.com, a mass casualty exercise being held in Fort Monroe, Virginia. That's, of course, at a military academy. Fort Monroe, I believe they already held it, yes, just a couple days ago. That, of course, involved the guys at the military school, along with local fire, police, medical response departments. The exercise scenario will involve multiple casualties from a major traffic accident, I'm sure. Good Lord. I think now we've got, if we jump to Reuters, U.S. pandemic flu plan would put Chicago on lockdown. Containing an influenza pandemic in a large U.S. city like Chicago would require widespread school closings, quarantines of infected households, and bans on public gatherings, U.S. researchers said 2 Mondays ago. But if done quickly and well, such steps could reduce infections by as much as 80%, said researcher Stephen Eubank at Virginia Tech. And of course, this was all based on a computer simulation of just such an event. And I've got a link to Eubank's Virginia Tech page and some PDFs. You can read some of their white paper think tanks. But right now, coming from WETM-TV, Bradford County stages disease outbreak drill.
Not if, but when. That's why the CDC wants our local governments to plan for the risks of a bioterrorism or disease pandemic. Today, emergency officials in Bradford County tried out their outbreak preparedness plan for the first time. WETM-18 News reporter Anna Liss has the story.
Bradford County is practicing its mass medication plan to help ease the concerns of people who don't think the government is well prepared to deal with a disease outbreak or bioterrorism event.
I don't have much trust right now in the government and how they would respond to things. I know that they're catching a lot, but they're missing a lot, too.
It could be any pandemic type, bird flu, anything that where the public would need medication on a large scale. It's something that we can't just go to a drugstore and pick up. This would be doses in the thousands.
Under this drill, authorities assume they've lost 70% of their staff. Schools and hospitals are the first to be put on alert.
And that's the premises, and that's what everyone actually plans for, that in a pandemic, you'd lose so many staff members and support personnel to manage your facility. And in that case, you would be having extremely high census because the general public, there'd be a lot of sick people.
Here at Robert Packer Hospital, as soon as the medications are received, patients, employees, and employee family members would have to receive them at this point of distribution. Members of the general public would have to line up at area schools.
Tawanda High School and Lynch-Boston Elementary School in Athens, those schools serve as mass vaccination or prophylaxis clinics for the general population.
Around 70,000 doses of medication were distributed as part of this drill. Officials say it was a success. In Tawanda, Anna Liss, WETM 18 News.
Mass vaccinations, my friends. And you can link over on that story. Actually, I believe that's one of the videos that I swiped from the WETM website and put it up to YouTube for you. But you can also link over to the Pennsylvania Office of Homeland Security and read what they got going on. Jumping to GCN.com, that's Government Computer News. This is a little heady. This gets into a little military intelligence and all the alphabets and intelligence and all that. New name for MassInt, that's MASINT, details emerge about futuristic spy tech. The intelligence agencies have renamed their MassInt program and will now refer to the spy discipline as the Advanced Technical Exploitation Program, ATEP. The name change surfaced in documents that describe a pending acquisition for contractor assistance in merging information from various types of sensors and systems to create cross-disciplinary intelligence. And there's a lot you can read about. MassInt stands for Measurement and Signature Intelligence, and that ties in with SIGINT, Signals Intelligent, or OSINT, Open Source Intelligent, or HUMINT, Human Intelligence. And you can go down that intelligence hole. You can also hit up FBO Daily, Fed Biz Ops, and read about the Advanced Technical Exploitation Program. Jumping to WDBJ TV7, first responders from more than a dozen agencies gathered at VMI, I believe that's the Virginia Military Academy, to prepare for a large-scale emergency. Yep. You can click on over to Virginia Military Institute and read about their emergency response exercise. So, a lot of military drills, a lot of pandemic drills, getting you ready, getting you desensitized. But let's finish off our drills with something that's not exactly being called a drill. But let's see. Let's get into this one. Practice bomb hits an Oklahoma apartment building.
It's no surprise to see rain, sometimes snow or hail falling from Oklahoma skies. You really don't expect much else.
Yeah, but I would take hail over this. Just a shocking arrival in an apartment complex here in Oklahoma. What it is, you're looking at it, it's a bomb. It was accidentally dropped by a pilot in a fighter jet. It fell right on the Canyon Creek Apartments in Tulsa. Now, the couple who lives in the apartment where that bomb hit thankfully wasn't at home at the time, and maybe better yet, the bomb itself, nothing more than a dud. It's simply used for training.
We did not take off out of Tulsa with live bombs. We don't take off out of Tulsa with live rockets or live missiles.
Probably a little training is necessary after this. The military is still trying to figure out how the pilot could have dropped the training weapon. How about this? He says he didn't even realize anything was wrong until he returned from his mission and found out where that bomb really did land.
Well, I say it may sound crazy, you know, but a military missile hit my apartment.
No, Jerry Isbell is not making this story up. On Thursday, a military pilot was on a practice mission when he mistakenly dropped this bomb onto the Canyon Creek apartment complex. The pilot thought he was over a Kansas field. Now, to be clear, the 22-pound bomb was equipped with a non-explosive dummy warhead.
It fell from the sky, hit the storage building, which is actually houses all the electricity, which is hooked basically onto my bathroom almost on the outside. And luckily, the missile hit down and drilled into the concrete because it blew up my bathroom wall.
This is the extent of the damage. Remarkably, no one was hurt. The Oklahoma Air National Guard says the fighter aircraft was en route to Salina, Kansas. There are conflicting reports as to why the pilot would have released the bomb.
It's just kind of random. It's not every day you get hit by a missile, you know?
The FBI and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms are both investigating.
We got lucky.
Ross Simpson.
There was no peace and quiet for residents returning home to their Tulsa, Oklahoma apartment. There was a rocket partly buried in the foundation, knocking out electricity. It was a 25-pound dummy warhead, similar to this, dropped from an Air National Guard jet. Tulsa police say the pilot thought he'd let the rocket go over a field in Kansas as part of a training mission. Instead, it ended up here, at the Canyon Creek apartment complex. No one was injured. The FBI and Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms are investigating.
Practice bomb. You bet your ass it was practice. So there's a few things linked up to that, and that's another video I swiped and put up to YouTube for you. TulsaWorld.com, inert bombs release investigated. So we'll see if they'll give it some whitewash. You can also hit up click2houston.com, bomb falls off military jet, hits apartment. I don't think it fell off. National Guard drops dummy bomb on apartment. And more, and you can read about the Oklahoma Air National Guard and the 138th Fighter Wing. Now, my friends, of course, what would an anniversary week be without another message beyond the grave from Emmanuel Goldstein, otherwise known as Osama bin Laden? Al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden will be issuing a new message timed to the fifth anniversary of the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq, one that now, of course, two-thirds of Americans are against. And that, of course, is tied in with the site Intelligence Center and Rita Katz, and we've gone all over that. Urgent very soon by the will of God, read the announcement of the new message. The response is what you see and not what you hear by the warrior sheik Osama bin Laden. Then, of course, the message came out. It's nothing but a still with a helpful English translation, which is always handy in text. So I'm not going to play any audio because, of course, you wouldn't understand it. But we also have Reuters. The message is entitled, "The Response Will Be What You See, Not What You Hear." And this was as the message was about to come out. So the 5-minute message is posted up. It's up on Google Video. Jump over to USA Today, and then we start to get the message from the message. Bin Laden threatens Europe over those controversial Muslim cartoons. Those damn things. Coming very soon to the internet near you from Osama bin Laden commemorating the fifth anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. That's according to the Al-Qaeda-affiliated Al-Ikhlas internet forum, which is monitored, of course, by the site Intelligence Group. And there's a few more. BBC. Bin Laden threatens the EU over the reprinting of cartoons offensive to Muslims. And of course, globalsecurity.org, John Pike, the head of that website, says that, you know, he's mentioning these cartoons because they're a crowd pleaser, not because it's 2-year-old news and they're trying to cobble together these bullshit Bin Laden tapes. Where are we going next? Washington Times, Bin Laden threatens EU over profit cartoons. And AP has the same headline. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, and yeah, that's right. There is an update coming from BBC. Bin Laden tape voice is authentic. U.S. intelligence agents believe the voice on a tape purportedly from Osama bin Laden was authentic. The CIA and the White House have said the message in audio only appeared on Wednesday on an Islamist website. There's a couple helpful links. Actually, the AP put up messages from bin Laden since 9/11, and it gives all the dates. Now, other people have done better work. Of course, I think actually even Keith Olbermann, who basically pinpointed all these terror messages. Actually, no, it wasn't Keith Olbermann. He did the thing about whenever they changed the terror alerts as they needed a bump in the approval ratings. But you can also look, of course, at all these dubious video releases and see that they're usually timed around some sort of moment of critical importance to this corrupt administration. Wikipedia also has helpful videos of Osama bin Laden and all their dates. And I haven't looked too much into it. I'm not sure if they mentioned the fatty bin Laden and all that. But if you head over to siteintelgroup.org, that's of course Rita Katz and her shady organization watching all those crazy Al-Qaeders. But at some point, the name of this message changed to, "May our mothers be bereaved of us if we fail to help our prophet." And then 911blogger.com has bin Laden's resurrection. And I think roguegovernment.com had CIA tries to scare us with another bin Laden video. But that's all I got for that right now. So, moving on, my friends. Writer, futurist, sci-fi genius, Arthur C. Clarke, dead at age 90. Arthur C. Clarke, a visionary science fiction writer who co-wrote 2001, A Space Odyssey, and won worldwide acclaim with more than 100 books on space, science, and the future, died Wednesday. He was 90 years old. Clarke, who had battled debilitating post-polio syndrome since the 60s, died at 1:30 a.m. in his adopted home of Sri Lanka after suffering breathing problems. Co-author with Stanley Kubrick of Kubrick's fantastic film 2001, A Space Odyssey, Clarke was regarded as far more than a science fiction writer.
Most of us know Arthur C. Clarke as a science fiction writer, most notably of 2001, A Space Odyssey. His impressive body of work puts him in the ranks of H.G. Wells, Jules Verne, and Isaac Asimov. Clarke has spent a lifetime imagining and writing about technology. In the 1940s, as a young officer in Britain's Royal Air Force, he envisioned using geostationary satellites as communications tools, well before there were any satellites. Now, of course, they're commonplace and have revolutionized the way we communicate and send information, as Clarke said in a recent video.
Growing up in the 1920s and 30s, I never expected to see so much happen in the span of a few decades.
Clarke has witnessed the dramatic outbursts of technology, from the first rocket flight, to the launch of the first satellite Sputnik, to the landing on the moon.
As a result of intensive work by research institutes and designing bureaus, the first artificial Earth satellite in the world has now been created. This first satellite was today successfully launched in the USSR.
A former chairman of the British Interplanetary Society and an early promoter of space exploration, Clarke was knighted in 2000 for his literary and scientific contributions. He's lived in Colombo, the capital of the island nation of Sri Lanka, since 1956. Now, 90 years old and in failing health, Clarke agreed to a series of interviews with Spectrum's Sasswato Das.
Thanks to the Danger Room blog on Wired.com, they pointed me to what you just heard. Arthur C. Clarke, the final interview. Now, that was coming from Spectrum, and they have what appears to be the final interview with Arthur C. Clarke, conducted in January of this year, where Clarke was already in the hospital. He discusses geostationary communication satellites, space elevators, and his thoughts on private sector travel. It's an interesting dialogue with a futurist and a visionary who lived to see some of his predictions come true, most notably the satellites. Space elevators, on the other hand, are still a ways off. Now, the clip that you just heard goes on and on to contain the final interview with Arthur C. Clarke, but I'm going to move on, my friends. If we jump to The Guardian, guardian.co.uk, Pentagon admits postponing brain screenings. Now, I posted up under the headline, DOD postpones brain scans for fear of what they'll find. The Pentagon has admitted that it delayed introducing a routine screening of troops returning from Iraq for mild brain injuries because it feared that the extent of the problem could mushroom to the scale of the Gulf War syndrome after the first Iraq War. The head of the Pentagon's Medical Assessments Division has told USA Today that he wanted to avoid another controversy as potentially huge as Gulf War syndrome. Well, maybe you should stop shooting off all that depleted uranium. He said the military feared announcing a screening program would encourage troops to think they had a condition and make correct diagnosis more difficult. So, USA Today has, Colonel says, DOD delayed brain injury scans. For more than 2 years, the Pentagon delayed screening troops returning from Iraq for mild brain injuries because officials feared veterans would blame vague ailments on the little understood wound caused by exposure to bomb blasts. Air Force Colonel Kenneth Cox said all this in an interview. About 10,000 veterans blamed medical conditions from cancer to eczema on their service. And if you recall, I believe it was last week, we went over Gulf War syndrome. Moving to monstersandcritics.com, coming from the DPA, Deutsche Press. Supreme Court to debate landmark gun case. The U.S. Supreme Court on Tuesday considered, and I believe they're still under consideration, whether people in the United States have a constitutional right to own firearms in a landmark case that could have far-reaching implications for gun control legislation across the country. The case itself surrounds a 1976 law in the District of Criminals that effectively bans handguns and requires all other legal firearms, hunting rifles and shotguns, to be disassembled and unloaded when stored at home. One of six Washington residents that sued the district, or rather, sorry, out of six that sued Washington, one case has made it all the way to the country's highest court. Dick Heller, a private security guard, argues he should be allowed to bring his handgun home after work.
I've been a gun owner for years and years and years, and D.C. passed this draconian gun law, the more I begin to become a student of the Constitution, the more I realized that it was an unconstitutional regulation, control over our lives. I bought pre-drug age, if that's a proper phrase. So it was safe at the time. And then right after I moved in, Coke hit the culture, and it became very dangerous. There was a period there for a couple of months where within a couple of minutes of 2 a.m., a guy would empty his 9mm into the air. It signified that drug trade was over for the day. And the police did nothing. A 9mm you can hear from a mile away, okay? This is the middle of Capitol Hill. Now, if they decided they just wanted to kick in my door and keep shooting, what is a citizen to do? So you have the constitutional right to defend your life, and then the city disarms you. The city is basically just created a victim. The government creates a victim class of citizens. I get up in the morning, I go to work, I pay my taxes, I pay my mortgage, and I'm a target for the bad guys. And that's not why government was created. Government was created to defend us, not disarm us. and people defended themselves with firearms before the Constitution was written, before the government was formed. And somewhere we lost that.
So that's the man in question, Dick Heller. That's a little bit of video from U.S. News and World Report. If we jump over to WashingtonPost.com, D.C.'s gun ban gets day in court. There's an article by Robert Barnes, and that came out Sunday the 16th. So you can go down that hole and read all about the Second Amendment and Dick Heller, and brace yourself for attacks from all sides on the Constitution. Going along with that, I believe if we jump to the BBC, they are covering the FCC. They are going to, or rather, the Supreme Court is picking up the FCC versus Fox case. U.S. court to rule on TV expletives. The U.S. Supreme Court has agreed to review the issue of expletives on the airwaves, a move that may reopen the debate over broadcast indecency. The court is to hear an appeal by the FCC. Their policy of fining networks for fleeting expletives or isolated utterances is on hold following a legal challenge by Fox. Analysts say the media environment has changed substantially since 78 when the court last ruled on this issue. The FCC toughened its stance on expletives after a 2003 broadcast by NBC at the Golden Globes award show when U2's lead singer Bono said that winning was fucking brilliant. And you gotta love the BBC for writing fucking brilliant. I believe that's coming up in the fall, but we're going to see the gun ruling much, 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 much sooner. We can jump to San Francisco Weekly. One of their blogs is called The Snitch. They've got Fox to FCC. Fuck you and your fleeting expletive rules. The CelebrityCafe.com has U.S. Supreme Court agrees to hear FCC versus Fox. And of course, as we mentioned, it's the first broadcast indecency case in 30 years. If you jump over to SourceWatch, you can read more about the Federal Communications Commission. But if we hop back to the Washington Post, staying in the District of Criminals. Dirty water, my friends. Man-made chemicals may put strain on fish. The Potomac River contains an array of man-made chemicals that could play havoc with animals' hormone systems, federal scientists have found in their best glimpse yet of the river's problems with a mysterious new class of pollutant. The research, unveiled at a conference last week, found more than 10 of the compounds, including pesticides, herbicides, and artificial fragrances. Through an accident of chemistry, formulas designed to kill bugs or add smell to soap might also interfere with vital signals in fish, amphibians, and other creatures. The scientists said they hope this new research might explain one of the Potomac's most bizarre discoveries. Some male fish have begun growing eggs. Scientists said there was no evidence of a threat to human health. So take a big old bite of Blinky. Taken with a recent report that drinking water samples from the river contain traces of drugs, the results provide troubling evidence about the river's health. People living along the Potomac, which I used to for about a decade, have widely tainted it with pollutants that scientists are just beginning to understand. Jumping down a couple paragraphs, the chemicals in the study presented at the conference held in Berkeley Springs, West Virginia, are suspected by scientists to be endocrine disruptors. This group of contaminants interferes with natural hormone systems, twisting or aborting the processes that hormones control. And the conference was sponsored by the Metropolitan Washington Council of Governments, COG. But I have the link over to MWCOG.org, Metropolitan Washington Council of Governments, and you can read about the Potomac Monitoring Forum 2008, Better Monitoring for Better Water Resources Management. And like I said, that happened back in my own old backyard of Berkeley Springs, West Virginia. Dovetailing nicely with that, coming from the AP, and of course they just mentioned the Dirty Water Reports, more drug testing of water sought. Test it, study it, figure out how to clean it, but still drink it. That's the range of reactions raining down from community leaders, utilities, environmental groups, and policymakers in reaction to an Associated Press investigation that documented the presence of pharmaceuticals in major portions of the nation's drinking water supplies. You should probably get a water filter, and not a little shitty Brita water filter. You should get a Berkey. They are awesome. Shifting gears madly, my friends. And as I posted this up, I incorrectly posted it up as Aussie filmmakers to release new JFK documentary. And I was quickly given the smackdown. They're from New Zealand. New Zealand is not Australia. I'm sorry, I conflated the two. It would be like if someone from me saying, oh yeah, you're from Virginia. From fucking West Virginia. So, it's fucking New Zealand. And a guy named Seamus Coogan is releasing a documentary called Imagining the Kennedys. There's a sketchy little sneaky preview trailer that is online, and I actually brought the audio, but I'm not going to play it, I just decided, because it's a lot of visuals and a lot of music, and I don't think it translates very well, but there's a couple good articles. If we hit up filmstew.com, a Kiwi take on the Kennedys. Despite being a very, very long way away from the grassy knoll, New Zealander Seamus Coogan has turned a lifelong fascination with the assassination of JFK into a new documentary. There's also a great one up on stuff.co.nz, The Killing of a President. Basically, three New Zealanders travel to Dallas for about a month and make a JFK documentary. So I think it's half fish out of water, half JFK investigation. So looking forward to that. And actually, the comment that told me to change it from Aussie to New Zealand said they had seen a screening of it, and it's really great. Put along with that is an editorial from dailyinterlake.com. JFK theories will never be exhausted. There's no shortage of diversions in this day and age, but only one that is guaranteed not only to last a lifetime, but to have the potential to solve the greatest crime in American history. Of course, I'm referring to the assassination of JFK. I'm well aware that many people have concluded rather dryly that the assassination was the single, solitary, demented work of one Lee Harvey Oswald. That's fine. Some people also think that paint-by-numbers is a form of art. That's Frank Mealy and his op-ed piece, JFK Theories Will Never Be Exhausted. Now, my friends, it's time to turn our eyes towards all the latest 9/11 news. What we're going to start it off with is the latest episode of Collateral News. It's a fantastic little 5-minute, kind of weekly news broadcast. It's up on YouTube, Collateral News. And so we now have the 39th episode, and it's called What Does He Know? Or, What Does He Know?
We are pleased to have him here with us to join us. Mr. Clark, could I ask you to raise your right hand so we place you under oath? You swear or affirm to tell the whole truth and nothing but the truth?
I do.
In the coming months, Collateral will present a series sorting through the best information on the 9/11 attacks. We will do this in addition to our regular weekly broadcasts. This week, we look at the human connections in the U.S. made by two alleged 9/11 hijackers who stayed on the West Coast with a known FBI informant. Those connections place a strain on the official story, which contends that the FBI had no knowledge of the 9/11 plot as it developed. Welcome to Collateral.
I also welcome the hearings because it is finally a forum where I can apologize to the loved ones of the victims of 9/11. To them who are here in the room, to those who are watching on television, your government
failed you.
Those entrusted with protecting you failed you. And I failed you.
Alleged hijackers Khalid Al-Midar and Nawaf al-Hazmi entered the United States on January 15, 2000, and immediately went to live with Saudi national Omar al-Bayoumi in San Diego. By May of that year, al-Bayoumi had helped the two find an apartment with landlord Abdusadr Sheikh. Sheikh was an FBI asset, reporting to Stephen Butler during the time the two hijackers were staying with Sheikh. That summer, in fact, Sheikh reported to Butler that two men named Khalid and Nawaf were staying with Sheikh, though according to Butler, Sheikh would not disclose their last names. Now, at this time, the CIA was tracking Al-Midar from the moment he arrives at the Malaysian summit in early 2000. It knows he has a multiple entry visa into the U.S., which he subsequently uses to leave and re-enter the country. Yet it keeps this information from the FBI, supposedly. The fact that al-Hazmi and al-Midar live with an FBI asset for months makes the FBI's alleged ignorance harder to accept. Making it even more difficult to accept is the fact that a few months later, al-Hazmi and al-Midar are spotted in Shreveport, Louisiana, by a private citizen, Dr. David Graham. Graham is the same man who was mysteriously poisoned in 2004 and dies 2 years later from his injuries.
About 10 months before 9/11/01, tragedies on that day, I was in a strange circumstance among some Muslim Arab-type fellows. And
Graham meets Al-Hazmi and Al-Midar while they're staying with the obscure Mohammed Jamal Khan in Shreveport, Louisiana. Graham then reports the meeting to the local FBI well before 9/11, complete with the first and last names correctly spelled of Al-Midar and Al-Hazmi. This is after, of course, Abdul Sadr Sheikh reported to Butler that Khalid and Nawaf were staying with him.
Because I guarantee you, the one I was looking at in this USA Today, 3 days after Spoon took the report, October 5th, 2001, this publication came out and identified Nawaf al-Hazmi. Easily.
Remember that Shreveport FBI agent Stephen Hayes intimated to 9/11 investigator Sander Hicks that Mohammed Jamal Khan may well have been an FBI asset himself. Now, when Congress was doing its joint inquiry into 9/11, it very badly wanted to speak with Abdul Sadr Sheikh, but the FBI forbade them from doing so. Still, the congressional investigators wanted badly to use Sheikh as a source. On November 18, 2002, a senior FBI official sent a letter to Senator Bob Graham and Representative Porter Goss, the chairman of the joint inquiry. Here's what it said, quote, "The administration would not sanction a staff interview with the source, nor did the administration agree to allow the FBI to serve a subpoena or a notice of deposition on the source," end quote. Senator Graham would later write, quote, "We were seeing in writing what we had suspected for some time. The White House was directing the cover-up," end quote. If the FBI truly knew nothing about the plot, how come Abdul Sadr Sheikh was forbidden from testifying to the Congressional Joint Inquiry? Again, we're left to accept the word of the FBI that he wouldn't have had anything interesting to say. But now we may never know for sure. Hope to see you next week.
That's episode 39 of Collateral News. What does he know? Diving into more latest 9/11 news, globalresearch.ca, 25 intolerable contradictions, the final undoing of the official 9/11 story. This is actually a review of the new book from Dr. David Ray Griffin, noted theologian, doctor, 9/11 professor. His new book is 9/11 Contradictions. An open letter to Congress and the press. And it's sitting in my shopping cart as we speak. At last, there's a book about 9/11 that politicians and journalists can openly discuss without fear of being labeled conspiracy theorists. 9/11 Contradictions advances no theories. It simply exposes 25 astonishing internal contradictions that will haunt the public story of this unparalleled event for all time. Until now, the persistent and disturbing questions about the day that changed the world have confused and alienated journalists and politicians because the technical issues regarding the collapse of the towers. Many have doubted the official story, have offered alternative theories which have been dismissed as conspiracy theories by a press which must understandably place a high value on its credibility. And also, of course, that the issue is now 6 years old and journalists are busy people and the world has moved on. There's another one, also up on globalresearch.ca. Griffin takes powerful new approach to 9/11 truth. 9/11 Contradictions by David Ray Griffin is the fifth of his books to examine the official account of 9/11. And they call it brilliant and highly readable. And of course, as I get my hands on it and we dive more into it, we will probably discuss it more on MediaMonarchy.com. But pressing forward, it's another visit from our friend Daniel Sinjata. Last year, the Tony Award-nominated actor and current star of Rescue Me on the FX network came out as a hardcore 9/11 truther. Now, as the rhetoric has been amping up, and as we've been talking about this for months and months and months, about framing the 9/11 truth movement as terrorists, our man Geraldo made a pretty bold statement. So I've got two clips here. We're going to hear what Geraldo said And then we're going to hear Daniel Sinjata's response on the Alex Jones Show last week.
This particular recruiting center has been the scene of demonstrations for decades. Sure. I remember during my day in the Vietnam era, that same, you know, it's right in the middle of Times Square. It's perfectly located. So it is where, you know, it's like a magnet for these crazy people, sure. for anarchists. That's what I think this is. This is I think that this bomber isn't Al-Qaeda, isn't anything like that. It's more, he's more like, it's a man. He's more like those 9/11 was an inside job kind of guys. They are protesting in a violent way, but in a violent way, almost like the eco terrorists, where they don't intend to inflict casualties.
But they do it in the middle of the night.
Middle of the night. He's making a political point.
They could have killed people with it had it been in the day, but they choose to do it at 3 a.m.
I really just literally was just chomping at the bit, myself starting to froth at the mouth, but just more with righteous indignation at just the unbelievable hypocrisy of Fox specifically, and also of Geraldo Rivera specifically, you know, saying that 9/11 truthers are violent radicalists who would do something like, you know, first of all, the only thing 9/11 truthers do in the middle of the night is our homework. We're not cowards. We are not cowards. They are the cowards because they refuse to engage us on the facts. What they want to do is they want to do these ad hominem attacks. They want to, you know, try to, you know, make people look like they're insane. They want to make people look like they're crazy. They'll attack the Charlie Sheens and the Rosie O'Donnells and the Marion Cotillards. Meanwhile, they won't address you. They won't bring you on TV to have a rational and reasoned discussion and debate based on the facts. So the only cowards in the situation are people like Geraldo and the other people that are using these probably CIA-given talking points to try to demonize 9/11 truth. It's unbelievable.
That's Daniel Sinjata speaking last week on the Alex Jones Show, quite livid about old Broken Nose, Al Capone's vault, Geraldo Rivera, framing the 9/11 truth movement as terrorists. That talking point, that meme, is floating around quite well. One thing I do have to throw to Geraldo, he had a show back in the 70s called Good Night America. I believe it was called Good Night America, you know, like Good Morning America. And that was the first place that the public ever saw the Zapruder film. And so this is in the 70s. This is a good decade plus after the JFK assassination. And most of the average public had never seen the Zapruder film. And of course, when they did, they all said, there's no fucking way that came from behind. And of course, it helped turn the tide. There's a lot of links, and you can read about Daniel Sinjata. We'll see if he gets any blowback, because of course his show, Rescue Me, is on FX, which is of course also owned by Rupert Murdoch and Fox, who he was just railing against. Kurt Nemo writes an article up on truthnews.us. Is the CIA's mighty Wurlitzer playing Geraldo Rivera? Another example of the truthers as terrorists talking point that corporate media hacks are emanating in unison, as we previously predicted they would. He goes on to talk about what a disappointment it must have been when that bombing wasn't traced to anti-war, nihilist, anarchist 9/11 truthers, but that didn't stop him from saying that it was. His article goes on to detail all the psyops and ops tied in with Mockingbird and the Mighty Wurlitzer. You should Google Mighty Wurlitzer. But we're going to move on to an article from Paul Joseph Watson. Top New York cop thought towers were bombed on 9/11. Former debunker Bo Deedle admits he shares 9/11 truth activist questions during a confrontation. Of course, done by We Are Change New York. Highly decorated former New York City detective Bo Deedle, that's D-I-E-T-L, admits that his first instinct on 9/11 was that the Twin Towers were downed with explosives, as he conceded that he shared many questions about the official story with 9/11 truth activists he had formerly debunked on national television.
What happened to World Trade Center Building 7, where we have firefighters?
I was there that afternoon. Yes. Okay, so let me tell you what happens now. The buildings come down. I'm in my office.
Yeah.
We shoot down there because they said people are trapped there and all that.
They were.
So we want to help cops, firemen, and all that. So I had a suit on. I go to the Army Navy store. I put boots on. I put dungarees, sweatshirt on. We shoot down there. All of a sudden, it's about 3:30 in the afternoon. Now, they're starting to say, get away, that number 7 is going to come down. Now, you got to understand something. When they go down, these buildings, I said, where the hell did these buildings buildings go.
Yes.
You're talking about 110-story
right.
buildings that fucking evaporate. Where
yes.
are the people? Where are the people?
Hold on.
I respect everybody here. Because
right.
I ask the same questions. It's such a devastating thing. I have four children. I've lost friends at John.
Yeah.
John, my friend from the FBI, was killed.
John O'Neill.
We lost a lot of family members. I just wish to God that it wasn't what it was. I had my daughter and my children up there for 3 weeks before the build. My daughter was, "Dad, we don't belong here. Something scary." She was crying. She wouldn't get out of the elevator. And then when I went down there, I stayed there till 6 o'clock in the morning trying to help people. There's nobody to help.
Sure, I was there
myself. There was nothing left. Everything was pulverized.
Yes.
Whatever. If we blew it up, if the government blew it up, where the fuck did all these bodies go? It was pulverized.
Yes.
And to me, that was...
Missing.
And you know what? No bones, no DNA were found.
Yes.
It's just something that
it
he
is.
Says, well, where's the body parts?
Yeah.
I didn't see no body
yeah.
parts. I got there around 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
So
all I'm saying is this.
Yeah.
If there's a conspiracy theory, I do agree with you on one thing. Fucking Bush and Clinton with their relationship with Saudi fucking Arabia.
Yes.
I agree with you.
Yeah.
They're kissing their asses like that. That's bullshit.
Right.
Because
yeah.
they're sucked up and that family that took off, that's a fucking crime.
Exactly. Right.
We all agree on something, okay?
My problem with this
whole thing is I was there. I can't understand where bodies went.
Me too. Okay, I can understand that. 45% of the people there are missing. But let me tell you this. I know many people who are affected as well.
Yeah.
One of them is Kevin McPadden, an Air Force medic who came down to help.
Yeah.
And he said he heard the countdown to Building 7 from 10 all the way to 0 before they took that building
down. Now, can I just say what there?
Yeah.
When the first plane hit, I was on the bridge going to the viaduct to my office. I was in the Daily News building. I got out of my car. I saw the second explosion. I didn't actually see the plane because I was too far away. The explosion was the size of the building in the center of the building, the second explosion.
Yeah.
Now, I rushed through. They closed the Midtown Tunnel. I show my badge. I shoot through. I'm in my offices. All of a sudden, now we're watching. I have a perfect view down there. And people start to scream. Now, they're on fire. We're saying, well, should we go down there? People are trapped and all that. We didn't go down there immediately at 10 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
Next thing I hear screaming. I looked up. And when these are coming down, you know what the first thing I says? They have fucking bombs in those buildings.
Yeah.
I'm telling you what was in my mind. I said, no way.
Yeah.
There had to be bombs in the building.
Former 9/11 debunker and top New York City cop, Bo Dietl. There he is when he's not on Fox News and he's had a little bit of time away and he's had his daughter plying him with 9/11 materials and maybe in a little more of a comfortable atmosphere. He thought they were fucking bombs. And you can read more about that and you can watch their whole video. We Are Change confronts Bo Dietl. It's about a 10-minute video. I just gave you a little taste. If we jump back to 911blogger.com from Kevin Fenton, one of the researchers over at cooperativeresearch.org. 9/11 timeline update over at the complete 9/11 timeline, or the terror timeline, if you like, Paul Thompson and others. A ton of updates. I can't follow all the links, but two, I can't even read the list of all the updates. Just the first paragraph. There's a ton of new material about the day of 9/11. There are more entries about the shoot-down order, which could have been issued around 9:38, 9:50, after 10, or 10:18. Regarding military exercises, some NEADS staff were still unsure whether the day's military exercises had ended. So, fighters from Otis were recalled from a training mission at about 9:03, and other jets on training were sent home at about 9:35. There were communication problems at NORAD and NEADS, which requested help from another air defense section around 10, and also for the three pilots scrambled from Langley. Of course, too late. We Are Change, of course, constantly confronting, quote-unquote, known politicians and movers and shakers and putting them on the spot, basically, ambush journalism about 9/11. So there's another one that I'm just going to pay a quick clip of, and it's another one that you need to watch the video because it's kind of brutal, and our man Larry Pullet Silverstein gets a little uncomfortable.
Regarding that quote, sir, the fire department commander at the time of 9/11 was Chief Daniel Nigro, and he recently made a statement in which he denied having that conversation with you about Building 7. And plus, we know from FEMA reports that the firemen were pulled out of the building much earlier in the day due to lack of water supply. So, sir, could you please get it on the record exactly who was it from the fire department that you spoke to about Building 7 on that day? Thank you.
What an answer.
What an answer.
Can we get a response, sir?
Come on to the next question, please.
Okay.
3,000 people died, sir. Can we get an answer, please?
Answer, answer,
shame
answer.
Shame on you.
Answer.
You know, okay.
Let me just say.
Thousands of people's lives were lost on 9/11. There are thousands of pages of testimony as to what transpired. Millions of hours were spent analyzing what caused those twin towers to come down and thereafter settle. All of that is public record. We don't have to spend any more time on that.
Then why doesn't the government have explanation? Then why doesn't the government...
Wait.
Then why doesn't the government have an explanation, sir? If you do, why don't they?
Okay. First responder heard the countdown of all Building 7 from 1 to 10.
Enough.
Okay.
The topic is the future of Lower Manhattan.
Sir, you're disturbing our educational mission here, which is...
This is education!
No one answered the question, but first responders, they know what happened, and they're coming forward, so...
Next question, please. Let's jump to our good lefty progressive friends at the Southern Poverty Law Center, splcenter.org. I dug this one out. I don't think anybody else has caught on to this one yet, but under their intelligence reports, talking about neo-Nazis, two key hate groups are on the move, and they detail... scumbag neo-Nazis in Detroit and Longview in Washington. But it was the part now down at the bottom that kind of jumped out at me. As they're talking about a rally in the Church of Jesus Christ Christian, a front for neo-Nazi Aryan nations, and a rally they had, and there was a counter-rally, and da-da-da-da-da. About 30 skinheads and other neo-Nazis attended the racist gathering, which featured hate rock bands, a reading of poetry based on Viking mythology, and a video about the myth of 9/11. Further conflating terror and hate speech with 9/11 truthers. Our last bit, I think, of 9/11 news coming from thinkprogress.org. Zelikow, who of course was the secret head of the 9/11 Commission, always on the phone with Condi, and Cheney and Rove, you know, in this independent 9/11 investigation. But basically, Philip Shannon, in his new book, The Commission, The Uncensored History of the 9/11 Investigation, which we've covered week in, week out, if only to illustrate that now even the whitewash mainstream media is coming around and saying, huh, maybe they weren't telling us everything. New York Times reporter Philip Shannon's new book, The Commission, paints a damning portrait of Condoleezza Rice. Shannon argues that Rice was uninterested in actually advising the president, but was instead more concerned with being his closest confidant. The Sydney Morning Herald prints an extract from Shannon's book and provides further details about Rice's incompetence. Of course, everything that she ignored, and you know, no one ever thought that they would hijack planes and crash them in. But if we jump over to the Sydney Morning Herald, there's a lengthy extract from Philip Shannon's book under the catchy headline of They Knew, But Did Nothing. And I'm not going to read that. I'm going to move on, my friends. Like I said, I think that's our last bit of 9/11 news. Jumping into now what's a little more pressing is our failing by design economy.
From Wall Street to Main Street, fears about the U.S. economy continue to mount.
Today, both President Bush and Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke said the government is responding and is prepared to do more to restore confidence in the economy. Jane Bryant Quinn, as somebody who studies consumer and consumer behavior, what do you look for next?
I am looking for, I'm afraid, not a very comfortable time for consumers. I expect that some of them are going to have to start saving more money, which they haven't done in the past, because they've always had easy credit, they've always been able to spend, and now they're not going to be able to get as much credit. They're not going to be able to borrow against their homes because of the decline in the equity of their homes. And so this is going to face, they're facing a retrenchment, because they're spending more on their gas, they're spending more for food, and they're their incomes are not going up and they're going to lose some jobs. So we're looking at a classic recession, and consumers are going to have to retrench. And you know, Judy, over the long run, if you look at where America is in the world, we're, relatively speaking, we are getting poorer because we've been a debtor nation for so long. And the dollar going down means that internationally we are getting to be a poorer country, and we are not doing as well as we did in the past. This is going to be a hard thing for Americans to face.
Sobering picture we're painting this Friday. Jane Bryant Quinn, David Wessel, thank you both.
This is going to be a hard thing for the American people to face. That's from PBS's NewsHour from just a couple days ago, and that entire 10-plus minute video is up on Raw Story and, of course, MediaMonarchy.com. I see now that we're well into hour number two of episode 68 of MediaMonarchy.com, coming to you Bad Friday, March 21st, 2008, from the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.org, and revereradionetwork.com. And I implore you to hit me up on MySpace, Dig, YouTube, and Yahoo with Media Monarchy as your keyword, and to please keep downloading and sharing and adding links to the Media Monarchy podcast, available at radioforall.net and archive.org. Still looking for somebody to help me out with a torrent on conspiracycentral.net. So I'll just throw that out there again. I'm planting seeds, my friends. We're having, it almost feels like a greatest hits episode. It's a classic episode of Media Monarchy. 9/11, the war, war games, drills, terror exercises, JFK, and now new news about no-name Maddox, better known as Charles Manson. New graves found at Manson Ranch. More grave sites have been discovered at a ranch where mass murderer Charles Manson lived. Investigators had always feared that Manson and his band of followers, the Manson family, may have carried out more killings. It is thought more bodies may be buried at the ranch where Manson, now 73, went into hiding after his cult's killings.
It is hard to believe, but tonight there's new evidence which could suggest Charles Manson and his followers killed others and buried their bodies on his ranch. In 1969, Manson's followers stabbed seven to death in a Los Angeles suburb. One was director Roman Polanski's wife, actress Sharon Tate, who was 8.5 months pregnant. In 1971, Manson and four others were found guilty of the murders. All are serving life sentences. A jailhouse informant had said Manson once told him he killed 35 people, and now there could be evidence to back that up. Before we talk to the cop leading the search, NBC's George Lewis has the story.
The Manson mystery. Could the leader of a murderous cult, now serving life, have masterminded other murders? And if there were other victims, could they be buried at the ranch in California's Death Valley, where Manson and his followers were arrested 39 years ago?
You ready to work? You are.
Police Sergeant Paul Dosti from Mammoth Lakes, California, has come here repeatedly on his own.
Go fine!
With a cadaver dog named Buster, and claims to have found evidence of humans buried here.
Well, there's human remains scent, without a doubt.
Last month, scientists from the Oak Ridge National Laboratory joined Dosti using equipment to search for odors emitted by decomposing bodies. Sergeant Dosti says the findings, just analyzed, show possible decomposition of human remains and the need for further testing and possible digging. George Lewis, NBC News, Los Angeles.
two questions here. Will the team's findings lead to digging? And we're going to look at actually Manson's own statements to figure out, are there any clues you can read from what Manson said in the past?
Maybe I haven't done enough. I might be ashamed of that for not doing enough. Maybe I should have killed 400 or 500 people. Then I would have felt better. Then when I felt like I really offered society something.
Manson convinced his followers to carry out the murder spree. He is currently in prison and is not eligible for parole until when? Oh, 2012. That was a quick little clip from MSNBC. The full-length video is up on MediaMonarchy.com. Jumping over to the Associated Press, forensic experts urge dig at Manson site. Dateline, Death Valley National Park in California. And my friends, you should go down the rabbit hole of Charles Manson and learn about his connections to Scientology and the prison industrial complex and even the Beach Boys. But if we shift gears over to the UK, teachers fear Big Brother takeover. Teachers fears over classroom CCTV. Teachers warned of an Orwellian surveillance culture developing in schools as more classrooms are fitted with CCTV cameras to monitor pupils' behavior. The Association of Teachers and Lecturers, ATL, voiced concern over how increased monitoring of lessons and pressure to get better exam results risks undermining the quality of education. New school buildings are being fitted with cameras to make sure children can be caught if they misbehave. This all according to Julia Neal, president of ATL. She was giving a speech and they had a new conference, and there are several British articles about this. We got the BBC. Big Brother schooling predicted education in England could soon become Orwellian. Soon? London wrote the book on Orwellian. Jumping over to the Telegraph. CCTV in class spies on teachers, says union. Big Brother style, Orwellian. Those are the pull quotes. Times Online, teachers fear rise of cyberbully parents and classroom cameras. This dives a little deeper, but all still coming from the ATL and one of their latest conferences in Torquay, T-O-R-Q-U-A-Y. If we jump over to The Guardian, keep Big Brother out of classrooms, says union. And we link over to atl.org.uk and their article, Big Brother is Watching You. Dovetailing with this article, jumping back to the BBC, pupils to take allegiance oath. School leavers, that's Brit speak for graduations. School leavers should be encouraged to swear an oath of allegiance to Queen and country, says a report commissioned by Gordon New World Order Brown on British citizenship. The report author, ex-Attorney General Lord Goldsmith, said it would give teenagers a sense of belonging. Council tax and student fee rebates are suggested for people who volunteer, as well as a Britishness public holiday. John Dunford of the Association of School and College Leaders said the citizenship ceremony was a, quote, half-baked idea. So there's a lot of links, and you can read about Lord Goldsmith, and I think there's even some video where you can watch a citizenship oath. But you can read about Peter Goldsmith, Baron Goldsmith, Lord Goldsmith, and all of his chicanery. You can link over to John Dunford and the Association of School and College Leaders, ASCL, and more and more and more. Now, my friends, let's get back to the USSA and first hit up WCCO.com. Target creates license plate reading technology.
New technology lets police cars go looking for trouble.
That's right. Computers in the cars automatically run license plates and alert officers to wanted drivers. Police in Lakeville are testing that technology right now. But you may be surprised who came up with it. Target. So what does that mean for shoppers? Tonight, Heather Brown explains why the popular store is setting its bullseye on crime.
Work every morning or pick up a prescription at your local pharmacy, or you could be pumping gas, and all of it could be caught on camera.
So it didn't surprise me that people weren't surprised that Target is thinking about taking pictures of the license plates that come into its lot.
I'm not doing anything wrong. Why should I have anything to worry about?
Target donated the technology to the Lakeville Police Department last month. It reads and runs plates through a crime database.
It makes it very simple.
Target doesn't have any of these cameras set up at the entrances to any of their stores in Minnesota yet, but they could by the end of the year. And they say these cameras will only go to help cops solve crime.
First, it starts with our premise that everybody has the right to work or shop in an environment that's completely safe and free from harm.
Target said it won't be used for any marketing and won't be linked to any database.
Perfectly legal.
That still worries some concerned about how easy it's become to collect data.
The reality is nobody wants to really live their lives as though they lived in a house of glass.
The system isn't perfect. Here at Red Offense says 11111. So Target says it'll take its time, figure out the privacy issues and the bugs, as we keep smiling for the camera.
And Heather says Target also has to figure out how to store those images and how long those images will be saved. Sounds strange, but Target actually runs a crime lab that's cracking cases around the world. Last fall, the store gave Frank Vassalero a rare look inside. Watch the video at WCCO.com/links.
Oh, you didn't know that Target was tied in with the Terranoia Industrial Complex? Well, let's just read, my friends. In 2006, the Washington Post revealed that Target is operating two sophisticated criminal forensics laboratories, one at their headquarters and the other in Las Vegas. Originally, the lab was created as an internal need for the company to investigate instances of theft and fraud and other criminal actions that have occurred on its own properties. Eventually, the company began offering pro bono services to law enforcement agencies across the country. Target's forensic services has assisted agencies at all levels of government, including federal agencies such as the United States Secret Service, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and Explosives, and the FBI. The labs have become such a popular resource for law enforcement that Target has had to restrict the cases it assists in to only violent felonies. So, my friends, much like Walmart, Target will be what they like to refer to as critical infrastructure. Those are going to be the organizations that when the shit hits the fan, they're going to be doling out the Soylent Green and lining people up. Because, of course, you know, we've got Target trailblazing in forensics. And, of course, Walmart, for a long, long time, has trailblazed in the complete RFID takeover of everything they have, top to bottom, shipping in, shipping out. But let's move on. Let's jump to KTHV. This is out of Little Rock. It's tough to keep up. But this is a new license plate scanner to look for lawbreakers. The Pulaski County Sheriff's Department is using a new system that scans license plates of passing cars, checking up to 800 vehicles per hour to see if any are stolen or if the owners are subjects of warrants. Sheriff Doc Holliday said the unit, known as Mobile Plate Hunter 900, is the first of its kind to be used in Arkansas. Holliday said the system can read plates of cars going as fast as 75 miles an hour. So make sure you're going 76. And you can link over to PulaskiSheriff.com. They're rebuilding their website, but you can send them an email or call them up and ask them what the fuck they're doing. And of course, I link over because they're linked in with the FBI's National Crime Information Center, NCIC. You can link over and read about that if you must. But if we jump back to Canada, red light cameras linked to crashes. Red light cameras used to nab drivers who disobey traffic signals can lead to more accidents and injuries, according to researchers at the University of South Florida College of Public Health. While cameras intuitively appear to be a good idea, analysis of data from 5 studies, including one in Ontario, show they often cause an increase in injuries and crashes. People who would otherwise run the yellow are trying to do a quick stop, and in doing so, they force everybody else to do the same thing behind them. The Calgary Police Service said it will review the U.S. study before making any comment. And of course, we know about Lockheed Martin running red light traffic cameras and actually decreasing the amount of yellow to increase the amount of money. We can link over to the University of South Florida's report, Red Light Cameras Increase Crashes and Costs. And you can read all about that. But if we jump over to KALB, surveillance cameras may soon be requirements.
Keechee Thompson is in favor of surveillance cameras in parking lots.
I think it would be a good idea to help protect and, you know, help make people feel a little more secure coming in and out, you know, facilities, shopping, knowing that they can come in, shop, make it to their car, make it home safe without somebody, you know, approaching them.
Justin Witcher also thinks they're a good idea.
I think they should be in every parking lot of any business.
Why is that?
To prevent crime. I mean, there's cameras out, nobody's going to do anything. You can't hide from a camera.
Councilman Myron Lawson said he wants to see businesses with heavy traffic put the surveillance cameras in their parking lots.
What I'm interested in doing is making sure that the larger establishments, and not limited to retail outlets, but also maybe hospitals, in addition to hospitals, looking at any area that they have a high density of traffic, they have some type of surveillance equipment to protect those that will be patronizing.
Two examples he gave were the Alexandria Mall and nearby strip malls. He wants the mayor's office to look into what other municipalities have done with similar ordinances.
Intention here is not to penalize any businesses and certainly not to become overly cumbersome on people's privacy acts, because I believe in that. But what I am interested in is making sure that people have the protection that we can offer them at an affordable price that doesn't invade the privacy.
In Alexandria, Joel Massey, News Channel 5.
My friends, one more bit of CCTV complete control takeover video. Jumping to Chicago, Illinois, and if we hit up /dot first, Chicago links school cameras to the police. Cameras in roughly 200 Chicago schools are being connected to police headquarters and the city's 911 emergency center. The goal of the effort is to consolidate video surveillance, end quote, or quote unquote, and it will involve both routine monitoring and real-time updates to officers on their way to a crisis. According to the Chicago Tribune, the mayor acknowledged the cameras provide only limited security, citing a spate of shootings in recent days that have claimed young victims during after-school hours. The story also contains a video in which corrupt Mayor Richard Daley Jr. indicated that he expects the cameras to serve as a deterrent now that people know they're under the eye of the panopticon.
Cameras will now be used to promote safety in Chicago schools. Mayor Daley made the announcement today at police headquarters. School cameras have been hooked into the 911 center, 4,500 of them. Pictures are taken in real time so emergency operators can see everything as it happens. The cameras will be posted outside the schools, not inside.
Well, it could prevent a crime, too. Let's be realistic. If a person knows they're going into a parking lot and there are cameras there, if a person knows he's going into a business and there are cameras there, you better believe it. They're much more reluctant to commit a crime if they're on camera.
On this side of the room.
Cameras have been used all over the city for years now to fight crime and promote traffic safety. They're posted in several different parts of Chicago.
I love that. Did you catch that? It could stop a crime, the mayor said. It could. Stranger things have happened. I have a rock that I claim keeps tigers away. I don't see any tigers, so my rock must be working. You can link over to chicagotribune.com. Chicago links school cameras to 911 center. And if you think this is an isolated case in a big city, think again, my friends. Of course, you know, recently we went over, you know, bathroom cameras, that kind of stuff. But there's other stories on myfoxchicago.com. And of course, it's after an epidemic of school shootings. And you can hop over to Wikipedia and read about Richard Michael Daley, of course, son of Richard J. Daley, one of course, the most corrupt mayors ever to grace the United States mayoral whole. Tying all this up is an article from Time Magazine entitled, Do Americans Even Care About Big Brother? Pity America's Poor Civil Liberties. Oh, no, I'm sorry, I misread that. It's even funnier. Pity America's poor civil libertarians. In recent weeks, the papers have been full of stories about the warehousing of information on Americans by the NSA, the interception of financial information by the CIA, the stripping of authority from Civilian Intelligence Oversight Board by the White House, and the compilation of suspicious activity reports from banks by the Treasury Department. On Thursday, that's two Thursdays ago, Justice Department Inspector General Glenn Fine released a report documenting continuing misuse of Patriot Act powers by the FBI. And to judge from the reaction in the country, nobody cares. All those illustrations I added links to, so you can read all about it. So first we head up ArsTechnica.com, an overview of the NSA's domestic spying program. In Wednesday's Wall Street Journal, a writer, Sieben Gorman, pulled together the disparate threads of reporting on what's known of the NSA's secret domestic spy program and combined them with some of her own reporting to confirm, once again, that the NSA's program is another incarnation of the Pentagon's erstwhile Total Information Awareness, TIA. Gorman also describes how Carnivore, the SWIFT database snooping program, and basically every other Big Brother database and data snooping program that the executive branch has ever developed over the past two administrations, feed information into the NSA's TIA-like system, which then looks for suspicious patterns in the data. If we jump to thespywhobuildme.com, they have an article called Contractor's Website Reveals Clandestine CIA Programs, and it's basically an ex-spook watching traffic to her website and looked at a suspicious one and followed the IP back to the source and found that it was a CIA front company. And so she said, if I found this out, couldn't other people? UPI, the Mooney Press, they have Bush taps DHS official for privacy board. President Bush has nominated the Chief Civil Liberties Officer of the United States Department of Homeland Security to head a revamped federal privacy panel. Donald Sutherland. Oh, no, I'm sorry. Daniel Sutherland. I wish it was Donald Sutherland. That would be much better. Mr. X. He was nominated Tuesday for a six-year term as full-time chairman of the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board. Bush also nominated two others to be part-time members of the board, Ronald Rotunda for a four-year term and Francis Taylor for a two-year term. The board, recommended by the fraudulent 9/11 Commission, is a mechanism to monitor and curb overreach by the federal government in its counterterrorism policies, was initially established by the Intelligence Reform and Terrorism Prevention Act of 2004. What this all basically means is that Bush is putting in his own fatherland cronies over a supposed neutral watchdog agency. If we jump now to USA Today, feds might be studying your finances. Each year, federal agents peek at the financial transactions of millions of Americans without their knowledge. The same type of information that raised suspicions about New York Governor Eliot Spitzer is reviewed every day by authorities to find traces of money laundering, check fraud, identity theft, or any crime that may involve a financial institution. And you can go down through that whole complete coverage about how they're watching your bank account. FBI abuse after 9/11 detailed, this coming from the Detroit Free Press, the FBI illegally collected information on citizens in 2006, continuing its misuse of expanded powers granted by Congress after the 9/11 inside job attacks. This was all found by an audit by the Justice Department's IG. The report said the agency violated rules for obtaining phone, email, financial, and other records using national security letters, NSL, a type of subpoena that doesn't need court approval. And of course, as we mentioned before, if you get an NSL, you're not allowed to say you got an NSL. It's pretty clever. Shifting gears from the Stasi land that we are turning into, we're now going to look at some of the bloody, terrible anniversaries we've had in the last week. First, we're going to hit the My Lai massacre. So our first article from the Deutsche Press Agency and monstersandcritics.com, U.S. shame still stings 40 years after My Lai massacre. My Lai, that's M-Y-L-A-I. Sorry, I mangle it. The soldiers of the 1st Battalion, 11th U.S. Army Brigade, arrived in the morning and their mission was clear. The orders were to shoot anything that moved, one U.S. Army officer told journalist Seymour Hersh, the investigative journalist who broke the story in 1969. As the brigade pulled out 3 hours later on that fateful day, March 16, 1968, the village of My Lai in South Vietnam's highlands was leveled. Not a living thing stirred. Blood-soaked bodies covered the ground, women, children, old men, dogs. Smoke from burning huts could be seen from afar, and the bodies of young women bore evidence of sexual violation. The number of dead ranged from 347 to 504, victims of a Charlie company gone amok in bloodlust. No one shot, or rather, not one shot, had been fired at the infantry. It would be another year and a half before the American public learned the truth, after a cover-up by the U.S. Army. We can hop over and get the AP report. My Lai marks 40th anniversary, and they talk about some of the soldiers and some of the victims. There's also one, I believe, from the AP. Survivors reflect 40 years after My Lai. But if we hit PierreTristam.com or Candide's Notebooks or some such unwieldy name, they do have posted up the complete transcripts of Seymour Hersh's work on the My Lai massacre. And it's quite lengthy and quite disturbing. It's interesting to note, and this kind of hit me as I was talking about it with someone else, Seymour Hersh broke the My Lai massacre. Seymour Hersh also broke the Abu Ghraib torture scandals. So the conspiratorialist in me says, maybe it's Seymour Hersh's job to find terrible dirt to demonize America, thereby hastening its downfall. Discuss. But you can hit up pbs.org, Vietnam Online, and read about the My Lai massacre. They have a lot of links and a lot of information. Here's an interesting one, though, and this is all embedded in the story, and this is actually jumping back to August 23rd of last year. President Bush links the war in Iraq to Vietnam. President Bush reached for historical precedence in his defense of the war in Iraq during a speech to the veterans of foreign wars. He likened the war in Iraq, a fight against extremism, to past conflicts in Japan, Korea, and Vietnam, saying at the core of them all is ideology.
There are many differences between the wars we fought in the Far East and the war on terror we're fighting today. But one important similarity is at their core, there are ideological struggles.
And I suppose he's right. At the bottom of the article, it makes reference to a forthcoming film from Oliver Stone. It's called Pinkville, which is one of the euphemisms for the My Lai massacre. One of the quick rundowns, I believe it's still in production and it kind of hiccuped through the writer's strike, but it's due out in 2008. Directed by Oliver Stone, Army General William R. Pierce, played by Bruce Willis, investigates the My Lai massacre, an event in which several hundred Vietnamese civilians were killed by U.S. soldiers. Saying in the Far East, but hitting up guardian.co.uk, Beijing locks down Lhasa as the crisis grows. This is jumping the article that I first have, jumping all the way back to Sunday, March 16th, where they say at least 10, possibly dozens, killed as violence spread and international protests mount. China flooded the streets of Lhasa with riot police as the international community urged an end to the bloodshed in Tibet that has already claimed at least 10, possibly dozens more lives. Security forces were also used to regain control of a second community as a protest in the Gansu province followed the worst riots in Lhasa in almost 20 years. Thousands of protesters smashed government offices after marching through the streets chanting support for the Dalai Lama, according to overseas support groups. Observer correspondent Tanya Brannigan said the crowd was dispersed with tear gas, but quickly regrouped. The disruption comes just months before the Olympic Games, when China's leaders had hoped to display a, quote, harmonious society. However, chaos has gripped everywhere, and it's home to a large community which considers itself part of the greater Tibet, even though it's outside the, quote, Tibet Autonomous Region. We can hit the Hindustan Times. U.S. asks China to address its policies in Tibet. The United States has urged China to, quote, exercise restraint, end quote, in dealing with the protests by Buddhist monks against the communist rule, and also to address its policies in Tibetan areas that have created tensions. Now, we can jump over to earthtimes.org. Germany calls for openness from China over events in Tibet. Dateline Berlin. The German government last Sunday called on China to show openness and transparency over the events in Tibet. Foreign Minister Frank-Walter Steinmeier appealed for an end to the violence in the Himalayan territory in an hour-long phone conversation with his Chinese counterpart. And on Saturday, Chancellor Angela Merkel expressed concern. So, dozens killed in Tibetan protest. There are, of course, lots of videos that China doesn't want you to see up on YouTube, so they just went ahead and blocked YouTube altogether. But The Guardian also has a quick little MP3 of an eyewitness account of the chaos and protest in Tibet.
Chinese riot police opened fire on protesters in Tibet on Friday, killing at least two, according to reports by Radio Free Asia. Peaceful street marches by Tibetan Buddhist monks over the past few days have given way to the biggest and angriest demonstrations the region has seen in nearly two decades, with armed anti-riot police patrolling the streets just months before the Beijing Olympics. The Tibetan Center for Human Rights and Democracy says that after a small peaceful protest by monks on Friday morning, hundreds of other monks, as well as ordinary people, joined in. By the afternoon, protesters were marching through the streets of the capital, Lhasa, torching shops and cars in protest of Chinese occupation. That's when the Chinese police allegedly opened fire. The eruption of anger comes despite Beijing's repeated claims that the Tibetan people are grateful for improved lives, and it threatens to stain preparations for the Olympics, when the Communist Party hopes to show off national prosperity and harmony. The Dalai Lama issued a statement on Friday, saying, quote,
I am deeply concerned over the situation that has been developing in Tibet following peaceful protests. These protests are a manifestation of the deep-rooted resentment of the Tibetan people under the present government.
So today, as we went out of our office in about 4 or 5 o'clock afternoon, we walk C'est la Lou, c'est la World, to the center of the city, and we are surprised because everyone on the street watching, like there is some kind of curiosity, we don't know what, we think maybe there is a party, maybe there is a special event today, and then we look at the center, and we see there is a lot of smoke coming from the center, so obviously there is fire, and we don't see much of Chinese, mostly Tibetan, but at this time yet, about 4 or 5 o'clock, we see also some Chinese outside, as there is no yet riot in our area. Then we walk, and halfway to the center, we see some people running, like scared. So we stopped, and we think, what happened? And then two people from on our right come to us and say, come inside the hotel, because there is some struggle outside. And we were like, okay, let's go inside, and then we will know what's going on. And then they told us that there is some fighting in the center of the city, and then we understand that the things. And in a few moments, the riots came to our area, too, mostly young people, but not only, and even we saw a monk sending stone, so we were a bit shocked about that, but that's, you know, I mean, people were just very angry, and people were using stone and sending stone, Tibetan people on the street sending stone to anyone who is not Tibetan. We had reports also from gunfire shooting in the center of the city, apparently, and later on we saw civilians that we would think possibly are either paramilitary or policemen in civilian camps with small guns in the hand, and I think they were trying to reestablish some kind of order.
There's more going on there than I have links to, but you can hit up Wiki News for anti-China protesters clash with police in Tibet. And of course, you can hit up and download and listen to that full eyewitness account up on The Guardian. Press TV has China police tear gas Tibetan monks. And finally, the first part of that clip, the Asia Brief report up on YouTube, Chinese police open fire on Tibet protesters. As we mentioned, of course, China blocks YouTube over Tibet videos. Internet users in China were blocked from seeing YouTube.com last Sunday after dozens of videos about protests in Tibet appeared on the popular U.S. video website. The blogging added to the communist government's efforts to control what the public saw and heard about protests that erupted last Friday in the Tibetan capital Lhasa, that's L-H-A-S-A, against the Chinese rule. Access to YouTube, usually readily available in China, was blocked after videos appeared on the site showing foreign news reports about the Lhasa demonstrations, montages of photos, and scenes from Tibet-related protests abroad. There were no protest scenes posted on China-based video websites such as 56.com, Youku.com, and Tudu.com. If we jump to the AFP, this all dovetails together, and of course, once I start ragging on the UN's most favored nation of tyrannical China, it's hard to stop, but if we hit up the AFP, U.S. drops China from list of top human rights abusers. The United States dropped China from its list of the world's worst human rights violators, but added Syria, Uzbekistan, and Sudan to the category in an annual report released Tuesday. The State Department's 2007 Human Rights Report said, however, that China, which has raised hopes internationally that it would improve human rights by hosting the 2008 Olympics, still had a poor human rights record overall. USS Condoleezza said the report was aimed at highlighting the struggle for human rights around the world. In the long run, we are confident that citizens who sacrifice for their dignity and their rights will prevail, just as the Havels and Mandelas did before them. Change will take time, but change will come, Condoleezza awkwardly said. And of course, flack from that, U.S. stands by dropping China from the blacklist. This from Press TV. USS Condoleezza defends dropping China from the human rights blacklist as the two countries have renewed talks on rights issues. She said, we just got to China to renew or to begin again the human rights dialogue that had been in limbo for some time. They love it. The New World Order loves China. They are the model. Coming soon to a country near you. Finally, in this last blast of China news, once again coming from Danger Room, China's weather control brigade. By now, and of course, if you listen to the show, we've gone over weather modification and weather wars and HAARP and cloud seeding and all that. By now, you may have heard about China's efforts to keep the Beijing Olympics from being rained out. Fox News says the Chinese weather controllers are hard at work. Despite their arsenal of 4,000 rocket launchers, 7,000 anti-aircraft guns, and 30 airplanes for reverse cloud seeding, they don't sound too sure they can hold China's traditional monsoon season at bay.
Stop wondering. The Chinese will. They can't get the lead out of the toys, but get the clouds to stop their drop on it. And the Chinese say they'll do it. Gain control of the weather. And they better. Just ahead of the Summer Olympics. Jonathan Hunt live with the news in Beijing tonight. Jonathan.
Shep, the Chinese aren't leaving anything to chance for their big moment, and they have some pretty ambitious ideas. In fact, by the time the Olympics are over, they plan to have us all convinced that in Beijing there is no pollution, in Beijing there is no traffic cat gridlock, and in the Chinese capital, the sun always shines.
This is the famous Bird's Nest, the $400 million Olympic Stadium. As you can see from this view of it, the smog and the pollution will be a problem during the Olympics, but there's another problem too. The Chinese government elected to build a stadium with no roof for ceremonies that will take place in August, monsoon season. But never fear, the Weather Modification Office is here. The gloriously named government organization, armed with 4,000 rocket launchers, 7,000 anti-aircraft guns, and 30 airplanes. And they can stop the rain, or so they say.
We are pretty confident that we can deal with those small clouds after several times of experiment. But to deal with those big ones is quite challenging. We are still working on it. But to be honest, we are not quite confident.
Cloud seeding, as the technique is known, is usually used to start rainfall over water-starved crops. But the Chinese aim to reverse the process, firing specially developed rockets into clouds, delaying the raindrops forming until those clouds move on. As you've heard, the Chinese insist they can change the weather at will. They can make the rain stop and start whenever they want. But frankly, I'm going to have to see it to believe it.
They try and make it sound like China's the only one fucking with the weather. Even though, of course, the U.S. and Russia, decades back, made pacts saying they wouldn't fuck with the weather. Yeah. That video is up on LiveLeak.com. But we're going to... Oh, wait. No, there's one from the L.A. Times. China plans to halt rain for Beijing Olympics. And dovetailing with that, Tibet uprising cracks the face of modern China. That coming from the Age.com.au out of Australia. And if we go back, way back to November 15th of 2007, up on MediaMonarchy.com was China leads weather control race. Not content to push the edge in cloning, architecture, and geological engineering, China's also leaving the rest of the world behind when it comes to controlling the weather. Again, they're just being a little more open about it. Barreling forward, my friends, another anniversary was 5 years ago. March 16th, it was in 2003, that an idealistic young activist from Olympia, Washington, went to the apartheid nation of Israel, and she was crushed by a tractor. So, 5 years later, Rachel Corrie's Case for Justice. There's a great article by Tom Wright and Therese Saliba up on Counterpunch. And it talks about how her parents are on their way, or rather already in, Tel Aviv to watch actually the first staging of the super controversial play My Name is Rachel Corrie in Israel, amazingly. And it mentions, of course, how her death was overshadowed by the shock and awe that was unleashed a mere few hours later. There are, of course, a plethora of sites dedicated to Rachel Corrie and her memory. The Rachel Corrie Foundation for Peace and Justice, rachelcorriefoundation.org. There's an article in theolympian.com, talks mark Corrie's death. Speakers addressed global peace efforts to commemorate the fifth anniversary of activist Rachel Corrie's death. You can, of course, hit up her lengthy Wikipedia entry. There's also rachelcorrie.org. There is a 90-minute documentary called Rachel, An American Conscience that's up on Google Video, fortunately again, because I had a version of it up about a year and a half ago, but when Google squashed my video account, I lost it and about 100 other videos. If we move to The Guardian, Rachel Corrie play debuts in Israel. Democracy Now! Has a bit about the play and the debate about why it's not opening in New York. That's going all the way back 2 years ago to 2006 in March. And finally, if we flash back to last summer, June 7th to be exact, up on MediaMonarchy.com, Theater Festival Under Fire for Rachel Corrie. And I basically detailed how the theater festival, the Contemporary American Theater Festival that I worked for in Shepherdstown, West Virginia, caught all kinds of shit for staging My Name is Rachel Corrie last summer and lost one of their big money funders. And I'll move on to the last brutal anniversary that we are observing in this last week, and that's worldwide protests against the fifth year of the illegal and immoral war in Iraq and Afghanistan and any and everywhere else. So if we hit up Wikinews, thousands attend anti-war protests in London and Glasgow. We can read about the Stop the War Coalition, which put on a lot of the UK demonstrations. Jump over to Press TV, anti-US demonstrations mark Iraq War anniversary. That was in the Belgian capital of Brussels, and they call it an anti-US demonstration. If we hit the Canadian press, protesters rally across Canada to speak out against wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. And if we come back home to portland.indymedia.org, it rained on our parade today, and our man Jim Lockhart has a lot of photos and also about a half-hour audio montage of the events here in Portland, Oregon, last Saturday for the anniversary march. And that's all I have to say about that at the moment. But Of course, I don't have to say anything because our man, Darth Cheney, has basically said all that needs to be said. So?
I really do believe we will be greeted as liberators.
We will be welcomed as liberators.
And they will welcome as liberators the United States when we come to do that.
We have not been greeted as liberators.
Well, I think we have by most Iraqis.
It was easy. We were greeted as liberators.
We talked to the vice president this morning in Oman. He would not talk about Barack Obama, but we talked about everything from Iraq to the economy.
Alan Greenspan described it this way: the current financial crisis in the U.S. is likely to be judged in retrospect as the most wrenching since the end of the Second World War. Correct?
We're clearly going through a rough patch here. There's no question about it. But we've had, prior to that, 52 months of uninterrupted economic growth. Now, of course, we've got problems in the housing industry and the mortgage backed securities, so forth, that have created problems that we're having to deal with.
Tell me what you said to the Iraqi leadership and how far you're willing to push them.
On the security front, I think there's a general consensus that we've made major progress, that the surge has worked. That's been a major success.
2/3 of Americans say it's not worth fighting.
So
you don't care what the American people think?
No, I think you cannot be blown off course by the fluctuation in the public opinion polls. There has, in fact, been fundamental change and transformation and improvement for the better. That's a huge accomplishment.
The vice president will continue his tour of the Mideast for the next week, where a major focus will be Iran.
Did you catch that? It was a little busy and a little messy in there. But that was the vice president of the United States being asked, what do you think about the 2/3 of the American public who are against the war? And he says, quote, So? We can hit a several-year-old article up on USA Today. Pre-war intelligence predicted Iraqi insurgency. Of course, we've detailed before that actually, if you want to look at it a little more of a brutal way, that the war in Iraq is a smashing success. They meant to go in and tear it all down and create endless sectarian war, so we'll have to be there for 100 years. And of course, at the beginning of the clip, as you heard, Cheney, as well as presumptive Republican nominee John Keating 5 McCain, saying, oh, we'll be greeted as liberators, it'll be a cakewalk. There's a lot of links in the We Will In Fact Be Greeted As Liberators posting up on MediaMonarchy.com. There's a handy, dandy, super long and ugly timeline of the Iraq War on thinkprogress.org. You can read about McCain saying that the Iraq War was easy. That's from January 10th, 2007. And you can hit up that video quite simply with Cheney and McCain saying that we'd be greeted as liberators. Now, what's important, bringing it back to the present day as we checked out the anniversary of the war, Cheney made a surprise visit to Iraq, and he asserted there that it's a phenomenal, successful endeavor. That's phenomenal, quote-unquote, improvements in security, hours before a suicide bomber killed at least 40 people. Cheney also asserted that Iraq has been a, quote, successful endeavor. Now, you can hit up McClatchyDC.com. Cheney cites phenomenal Iraqi security progress as bombing kills 40. And, of course, the official Chinese news agency is even reporting Cheney says U.S. endeavor in Iraq successful. And Raw Story has the video asked about 2/3 of Americans' opposition to war. Cheney says, so? And it's got about 3,500 digs on it. So that's a popular one. There's even the press release. Okay, dig this. When ABC News put out their report that has it saying so, the White House came out with a transcript and a press release that tries to say that ABC did some funny editing to make it seem like he said so. So, the transcript's there. You can read it, but so. On the anniversary, this is the last bit about Darth Cheney. Jumping back to the Washington Post, Vice President says Iran may have resumed its weapons program. Dateline Oman, Vice President Dick Cheney retained his tough stance against Iran on Wednesday and said the U.S. is uncertain if Tehran has restarted the nuclear weaponization program that a U.S. intelligence report says it halted in 2003. Speaking in Oman, a U.S.-allied Arab monarchy and neighbor of Iran's, Cheney told ABC News the important thing to keep in mind is the objective is blah, 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 blah. What's implied here, my friends, is that on the fifth anniversary of the war, Cheney was on a yacht in Oman with his Middle Eastern oil buddies. That's going to just about do it. Alex Ansari, alexansari.com, my favorite talk show host here in Portland, Oregon, does a weekly show on Portland Community Media on cable access called Outside the Box, and then he posts it up to Google Video. I believe I've mentioned, and I think he mentions it, he's having some computer difficulties, so the episodes coming up to Google Video have been a little sporadic. So out of the blue, episodes 142 and 144 showed up. Still looking for episode 143. But in 142, he once again talked to Leon Legant, a prestidigitator, a futurist, if you will. And they talk some scary talk about visions he has of the West Coast being invaded by Russia and or China and or the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Episode 144 of Outside the Box ran March 13th, so a week and a day ago. But it was when Daniel Estulin was in Portland talking and giving a long lecture last Friday night about his book and about his missions. His book is called It's the Bilderberg Group. It's the BilderbergBook.com. And so on episode 144 of Outside the Box, Alex Ansari had Daniel Estulin in studio for an hour-long interview. And it's all up there, and I've run out of time, and I can't play a clip from it. But that's just as well, because I think you've probably heard enough. But last bit of business, as I do at the end of each episode, is give you the little rundown of a short list of some of the interesting characters that land on MediaMonarchy.com throughout the week. I take little notes. So, in the last week, we had Whole Foods. We also had South Command, Southcom.mil. That's, of course, the counterpart to Northcom and the military-industrial post-9/11 complex. They were on MediaMonarchy.com after hitting my link on SourceWatch.org. They were reading about the Federal Reserve. We had the Pentagon.mil. They Googled Cyberstorm 1 and 2. We had Goldsmiths College in the UK. We had Booz Allen and Hamilton. They Googled Cyberstorm 2. The Lehman Brothers Googled China-Tibet blow-up. We had at least two visits from the Drug Enforcement Administration. Will you never get tired of visiting MediaMonarchy.com, DEA? I love it. Northern Kentucky University Googled Thomas Winkowski customs corruption. We went over that last week. Basically, the head of the Customs and Border Patrol had to send out a memo telling his people to knock off all that criminal activity. Sony BMG, we're reading about another look at Jonestown. That's about a year and a half posting about a new documentary about the Jonestown massacre. Oxford University Googled Muse terror storm. Reading, that was, of course, Matthew Bellamy, lead singer of Muse, at their huge headlining set at the Reading Festival last summer, I believe. He wore a big shirt that said Google terror storm. That's, of course, Alex Jones's documentary about the history of false flag terrorism. Hot Sauce Marketing in Edgewater, Wisconsin, Googled Charles Manson. And finally, we had the University of New South Wales. And that's just a little bit of the interesting visitors to MediaMonarchy.com throughout the week. My name's James. I'm your host and webmaster of MediaMonarchy.com. This has been episode 68, coming to you Bad Friday, March 21st, 2008, from the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.org, and from revereradionetwork.com. You can also, of course, hit me up, MySpace, Dig, YouTube, and Yahoo, using Media Monarchy as your keyword. And, of course, please keep downloading and sharing the podcast. RadioForAll.net and Archive.org is where they are available, my friends. And so, on this Good Friday / Easter weekend, I'd like to leave you with words that the late, great Bill Hicks said about the insanity of Easter. make goldfish, leave Lincoln Logs in your sock drawer. But what I also want to tell you is, like my man Webster Tarpley says, get active or get radioactive. Take care.
Thought police would get him just the same.